Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha. We're doing things a little differently this week, which is why you're getting this solo introduction from me. A few days ago, I had a chance to interview Madeline Sammy and Jackie Van Beek, who wrote, directed, and starred in this new comedy on Netflix called The Breaker Upperers. We haven't done a lot of interviews on the podcast, but The Breaker Upperers is a really funny movie, and we had a fun conversation, so I hope you enjoy it. Afterwards, you'll get the panel discussion we usually do, which is a more in-depth conversation about Russian Doll. That's the show that John Cheever and I talked about last week, but we hadn't finished all the episodes at the time. This time, we will get into spoilers, but even if you haven't seen the show, you can listen to the first part of the review safely. Anyway, here's the interview. I am here with Jackie Van Beek and Madeline Sammy, the writers, directors, and stars of The Breaker Upperers, a new film on Netflix. It's not the easiest concept to explain, so I'm going to sort of offload some of my duties. And do you guys mind sort of just explaining the idea behind the film?
No problem. It's about two women who go into business. They start a company that breaks up couples for cash, essentially. That would be the premise of the film.
It's the premise of the film.
Yeah, breakups.
Oh, well, you guys have it down. That was very smooth.
Thank you.
They're called The Breaker Upperers.
I could do a more bumbling virgin of you.
No, that was
a
great.
A bumbling virgin.
I got virgin.
Yes, you did.
So it's called The Breaker.
That's our next film. It's called The Bumbling Virgin.
Well, there, you heard it here first. So it's called The Breaker Upperers.
Yeah, well done.
Was that always the title?
It was a working title, and then it stuck.
Yeah,
well, I think I came up with it.
Madeline came up with it, and we just thought by the end, it's so brilliant.
I think it captures the tone of our film, like, quite silly, but it's also what the film's about.
Did anyone try to convince you to just shorten it to The Breaker Uppers, or that was never going to happen?
No, lots of people make that mistake, and they'll say The Breaker Uppers, or we'll see it written, and we always correct them.
We're like, no,
it's The Breaker Uppers.
There's an extra "er." So add the extra error, please.
Mm-hmm. Right, but that's intentional. That's what you're going for.
We kind of want to trip people up with the title.
Yeah.
It's a little in-joke for us.
We like it. It keeps us amused.
Yeah.
So you, as I understand it, started working on this 5 years ago-ish?
Yeah, in 2013 was when we came up with the idea.
Ago.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's a long time ago.
Well, every year, it gets longer by a year. That's what I found. Like, last year, if you'd asked me that, I said, yeah, I would have said 5 years ago.
That's
that
crazy.
You asked, I know, yeah, because we
that
keep,
is crazy.
Time is an amazing thing.
It is.
Song
she has a song for most things, you'll find.
Into the future.
Do you remember what the initial conversation was that eventually led to this film?
Yeah, I came up with the concept kind of all of a sudden, just by myself in my kitchen. And I was thinking about how many conversations I'd had with people about the level of dread that they have when they realize they have to break up with their partner. I mean, nobody enjoys it. And I thought, I bet you could make a lot of money out of doing that for somebody or offering to do that service for somebody. And I never set up the business, but I rang Madeline and said, what about this as a premise for a film? So we just started kind of jamming around that idea. I went over to her mum's place. We had a cup of tea by the fire, kind of Kiwi style, say.
Yeah, and then we just started writing. We were sort of writing in between different projects. Jackie was finishing her film. I was doing some directing and some writing another film. And then it kind of just gathered momentum. You know, we had a lot of support from the New Zealand Film Commission in New Zealand, who fund films there, and then we
pitched it to a company called Picky, which is Kathy Neal and Taika Waititi's company, and they're both good friends of ours. I mean, everyone in New Zealand knows everyone, so it sounds like we weren't really pitching it to a company. We were like, hey, Kathy, do you want to make our movie?
Tell your mates over a beer.
Yeah.
And then we got to make the thing, which was awesome.
And did you know from the start that not only were you going to write it, but that you were going to be the main characters and the directors?
We definitely decided that we'd co-write and co-star in it. And then a bit further down the track, we thought, oh, let's just co-direct it. I mean, who can we possibly hand it over to at this point, you know?
Yeah, there was a little trepidation when we... Because, you know, like, we knew that it'd be a lot to take on. And so there was a little hesitation for us to direct it because we didn't want to take the fun away from it. You know, we didn't get too stressed. But then it ended up just being kind of a mad circus and quite fun anyway.
Yeah, it was fun. We were worried that if we took on directing that we'd become... become less playful as actors. Yeah. And there's a lot of improv in the film, and that's what Madeline and I
love to do.
Yeah. And so, but that didn't turn out to be the case. It was just, like Madeline said, a mad circus that was quite fun. Yeah, really fun.
Had you ever directed anything together before?
No.
Never, no. But we did get to test it out, the directing relationship. We shot like a proof of concept to see, actually, if, you know, we wanted to see, we had a feeling it would work, but we wanted to see what it would be like. And we sort of naturally fell into it. We did it well. There was no major bust ups.
You know, but it was good to test it. Otherwise, I think we might have been a bit more nervous about, you know, what if Madeline goes ape shit at me? What if Jackie throws
it? And the thing about it on set, like, it worked really well, because what would happen is if one of us was in a scene more, then one of us would direct more, basically. That was the kind of loose thing.
The guy
that we had on set. So if Jackie was in a scene, she'd be in makeup talking to actors, and I'd be with camera talking about shots, and then we'd kind of see each other, cross paths, and go, oh, we're going to shoot like this. Are you happy with that? Yeah, cool. I've told the actors to do this. Oh, yeah, that's a great option. And then we'd shoot it. But we shot this film in 25 days, so we didn't have a lot of time to kind of muck around. And we kind of knew our film inside out, so it was about kind of just staying on the correct path in terms of the story and not going off on it. On a tangent too
on
much.
Improv tangents. Yeah, making sure that we ticked off the story beats before moving on, you know?
Yeah, talk a little bit more about, you mentioned that there is a fair amount of improv in the film. How do you do that when you've got, I imagine, a pretty tight timeline and limited budget?
Yeah, what we decided to do was to kind of nail the script versions first and then try and get into some improv with as much time as we had left.
That was the aim. Sometimes it didn't... I mean, you know, there was a couple of scenes, Jackie, where you turned up and you said, oh, actually, me and Cohen just rewrote this on the weekend, so we're just going to try out a few things. And I was like, what about our rule? Okay, it's thrown out. But the good thing about Jackie and I is that we're both pretty easygoing. We both like a bit of danger and excitement.
Yeah, it's exhilarating. Yeah. And then we always had, you know, a version of the script to fall back on.
Yeah, exactly.
It worked well, yeah.
And, you know, we also, because we do have the background in improv and improvising and improvising theatre and stuff like that, I think it's, we're not scared of having to go there if we need to, if it feels like the written script wasn't working or... Mm. Wasn't dynamic enough, and we deliberately also cast actors, our friends, who we all knew were good improvisers as well, so we felt safe with them because we knew that they would be able to bring it, you know. Mm-hmm. bring it
We knew that someone would come up with something at some point. Yeah. Pretty much.
Say something funny. Sometimes that would be the direction. Be like,
say something funny.
Let's come up with something funnier. That's not how we direct at all.
but sometimes
it'd be like, oh, say this.
So speaking of limited resources, there is also a Celine Dion song that plays a pretty crucial role in the film, and I'm curious, was it hard at all to get the rights to that song?
I don't think it was hard. I mean, it cost a bit.
It cost a bit. I think there's like a certain path. There's a pathway you have to go. It takes a long time.
It takes a long time to get the rights approved.
You can't. Yeah, it's a fine line too, because you know it's a very. It's an homage to Celine. We love her very much. Mm. But there was a chance that she could find what we were doing offensive, which thankfully she didn't.
She didn't. She we met with her, actually, and she's happy to meet with us. Yeah. I can't think of anything to say.
But you knew that it was really always going to be that song, or...?
From early on.
I mean, I think it was... I'm a huge Celine Dion fan. That is actually my karaoke song.
I actually sing that at karaoke as well, but it's a lot less well.
It's such an epic song. It's got everything in it. And I loved that it was 90s. It was potentially a song that could trigger a nostalgic memory in Jen's brain, which is, you know, she's having this flashback. So there was a reasoning behind it. And then also just the literal cheesiness of the lyric and her having this memory is just too much to... it's too great to not have in the film.
Yeah, and functionally, I mean, we were just trying to expose the backstory of the characters in a sillier way than a phone call.
The dialogue. Yeah, we actually had a scene where there was just a dialogue, this boring dialogue of like...
Boring.
oh, what about that, man? We don't talk about that. It's just like, oh, we got to find a better way.
Yeah, much more fun to make a bad video.
Bad karaoke?
Well, I fully support karaoke in film in general.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Yeah, we're going to try and put a karaoke scene in every film.
Absolutely.
We'll be singing the next one. It'll probably be something country, Jackie.
Yeah, I do love country music, so maybe I'll sing Dolly.
So another scene I wanted to talk about was, and I don't want to give anything away because this is probably my favorite scene in the movie, is there's a scene that takes place in a police station. It involves dancing. And I was wondering if again, trying to sort of walk around spoilers, can you just talk a little bit about where that scene came from and what it was actually like to shoot it?
Well, the kind of the broader sequence kind of came from, it's quite hard without talking about any details, but I'm not going to, came from basically our characters kind of setting up a lie and that being set in motion and then having, then the lie kind of snowballs and it kind of becomes out of control. And so then we're just having to do a lot of stuff we hadn't planned to do.
No, yeah, there's a lot of desperation. It was about sort of pushing these characters into really uncomfortable places.
Where they were kind of in over their heads a bit in a very silly comic way. Yeah. And like you say, there's some fun kind of ridiculous, awkward dancing involved. Yeah.
Did you know on the day of, had you like written into the script, this is exactly how far they're going to go with the dance?
Well, we'd written in... the script was just like
take.
That. This
we
all
had
happened.
One take. For some reason, no one wanted to see me strip multiple times, and I don't understand why. But it was one very long take. It was mainly time. It was we shot a lot in that scene, and we had a lot to cover, so we only had one go at
just try and fit in all the options before someone yells cut. Because we'd never yell cut because we always just loved our performances so much. I was often our producer who'd yell cut on our set.
I was exhausted by the end of it. It was a lot of fun to shoot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun to play scenes where you're doing something ridiculous but trying to keep a straight face. I find that
you're trying to fix something.
Well, and it's also fun to play as an actor opposite the other actors because I love to see if I can make other people laugh and break their character.
Oh, yeah.
I always feel like it's a good sign if you can make people break character. And I feel like the lovely Celia Piccola, who plays Anna in our film, was finding it very tough that day, which was a good sign.
A good sign. She's Australian, actually, but you guys probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference between New Zealand and Australian, I guess. For us, she's very different. She's from across the ditch. Very, very different accent for us.
The difference between Australia and New Zealand is we say six and they say six.
Yeah.
But she was Australian playing Australian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. 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 Very different.
No one has any.
For us, it's so obvious. So.
Yeah. New Zealanders are a lot sexier.
What would you say? Sexier?
No, New Zealanders are smarter. Australians are sexier. Like,
well, they're more like surfers.
Chris Hemsworth is sexy.
They saw.
One other scene I wanted to ask about, Jackie, was that you got to shoot a sex scene with Jemaine Clement. What was that like?
That was awesome. I mean, what a career highlight for me.
Jackie and Jemaine are old friends.
We're old buddies.
And it was such a cruel thing that Jackie asked of Jemaine to be in that scene.
I had to beg him because, I mean, he's a very good friend and very old friend of mine, and he was helping us up. And the week before we went into production, he was in the rehearsal room and doing some rewrites with us. And then I kind of cornered him and said, oh, there is one other thing, Jemaine. There's this little scene. It's a little scene in bed. And I'd just love you to play the role because you're an old friend and I don't want to go to bed with a stranger. And he just looked so horrified, but he's so nice that he was like, oh, all right.
But he enjoyed himself. It was hilarious to direct because I wasn't in the scene, so I could direct most of it. And just trying to get Jemaine to get closer to you.
He was so far above me.
I was like, drop in, Jemaine. He just didn't, you know, good old friends don't want to really rub genitals if they can avoid it.
No.
Even if it's just pretending. It's just not a...
He was like...
Sex scenes are always
awkward.
He was
like half a metre above me, though.
Luckily, it was supposed to be an awkward sex scene.
Yeah.
Because I think there's definitely a great awkward energy.
Oh, there's awkwardness, yeah.
It was extremely awkward, I mean, to watch as well. So.
10 out of 10, then.
No one is turned on in that scene. No one watching it, no one in it.
No.
10%. You know this is being recorded, eh?
Oh, right, is that big
I don't think Jemaine hasn't seen the film yet.
No, he hasn't seen it yet.
No, but there was that wonderful anecdote.
What was the anecdote?
Wasn't there the wonderful anecdote that you should tell people on the podcast?
What was it?
that Jermaine hasn't seen it.
Oh, he hasn't seen it, but yeah, okay. He hasn't seen it, but apparently the film was played as a fundraiser at his child's school. So all the parents at his child's school have seen it. That's awkward. I mean, that's more awkward than the sex scene, isn't it? Yeah, that's bad.
Poor Jermaine.
Probably
never going to see it now.
Right, and also, I mean, this movie has been out in New Zealand for like a year now. Why hasn't he seen it yet?
He's never in New Zealand.
He works in the States, he's in Toronto, he's in New York and LA. We opened in May,
I'm going to tell Jermaine I'm not going to watch any of his stuff until he sees
The Breaker
Uppers. Yeah. I watched a trailer for it.
There's even DVDs. He could get a DVD and watch it, couldn't
he? I want proof that he's watched it as well.
Well, you guys were talking about the fact that, you know, a lot of these people who are now celebrities in the United States, Jermaine, Taika, are your friends, and that you sort of joked about everyone knowing everyone. In fact, there was a joke about that in the movie. Mm. I'm curious
those
now.
Those guys are sort of like the male versions of us.
Oh yeah, that's nice. Well, you also called our film earlier in an interview today. Madeline called our film
the bird box
of comedy. I'm like, what are you on about?
Yeah, go on. What do you mean by that?
Sarcastically bigging us up.
Curious. You know, now that you've had some of these successes, and obviously you guys have had successful careers as well. I mean, has the feeling in the New Zealand, you know, comedy industry, the New Zealand film industry, do you feel like it feels different now than it did, 10 or 15 years ago?
Yeah, feels really different. I feel like, people used to think of New Zealand film as, Peter Jackson, or we do some
like
brilliant dark
creatures,
dark dramas.
Drama, yeah.
But now,
the piano.
Yeah, beautiful films. But now, people are really identifying, people will come up to us and say, that's New Zealand comedy. They'll do it with the American accent. I'm not going to do it. Okay, I'll do it. That's New Zealand comedy, they'll say.
It's been a slow sort of...
Perfect.
Importing New Zealand comedy into the American psyche has been happening over a long time. Like, it started with kind of like Flight of the Conchords, which was kind of a very unapologetically New Zealand comedy set in New York, and which, got a kind of cult following. I mean, it was probably more than a cult following in the USA.
Well, they do stadium tours.
Yeah, exactly. They're huge.
Right.
But then, it sort of really hit home for me when we were flying over to Austin for the premiere of our film, and I got to watch Thor for the first time, which I hadn't seen.
You watched Thor on like the back of your airplane?
Yeah.
I saw it in the cinema.
Okay. I have a young baby, so I haven't been to
Have you told Taika that you watched it in the plane? He wouldn't care.
He'd love it. It was a very, Taika managed to get a lot of New Zealand humor in that, and he plays a whole New Zealand character. And I was like, how did he get away with this? And like, how are people, people are loving this, And so, and then when we got to Austin, and the response from an American audience was just as big of a response as we'd get from a New Zealand audience, we knew that there was definitely an understanding and a change in the way people, it isn't about, people understand our accent now. 10, 15 years ago, I was doing auditions and being told, maybe just soften your accent, or maybe just don't do your New Zealand accent, whereas now people really understand it and know it. And so, yeah, I think there's definitely been an infiltration of New Zealand comedy into America.
Yeah, and like you say, Thor really, drags New Zealand comedy into the mainstream,
Yeah, because it has a very New Zealand undertone
right.
to it. Thor,
yeah, very
It
Kiwi.
Feels very strange to talk about Thor in that context, but for sure, 100%.
Oh, yeah. It felt so Kiwi to me when
really
I saw it.
It's really different to the other
it.
Thor films. You can feel Taika's presence and his sensibility all over that film, and I'm so happy that he got to express that. And I think the franchise is, it really gave a breath of fresh air into that that story, which is cool.
Well, and when you were writing and shooting The Breaker Uppers, to what extent were you thinking about whether or not the jokes would translate to an American or to a global audience?
Well, we never thought it was going to play beyond New Zealand.
No, we didn't really. We were just kind of make the film.
We never thought it was going to go into a festival. We were trying
we
to make
didn't
the,
know, really, did we?
We were trying to make the funniest film for ourselves that we were proud of.
we really committed to it being like, we really wanted it to feel really Kiwi. And I remember at the test screening, we had this big test screening with 350 people and they all filled out anonymous surveys and things. And one of the main things that came through is they felt like it felt really Kiwi to them. And that made me so happy. I was like, you know, because we were nearly at the end of the editing process at that point. And that was a big tick. But we knew we had a very universal theme and concept. So it was nice to kind of make something very specific, which felt specific for us. But we thought, well, you know, we it will be it's relatable.
Yeah, and we wanted to make a movie for women and for women, for, you know, women like us that are...
You were going to say older women
in their 30s.
Or 40s.
Or, you know, people that just don't have their shit together, you know, like... We wanted to kind of upend some of the stereotypes from rom-coms and romances and kind of put a bit of a twist on them. And so we were focused, that was what we were sort of focused on, making a kind of fresh, silly, heartfelt film. And then...
And a kind of a celebration of friendship, yeah. But rather than like conventional, you know, yeah. Church weddings
happy,
and...
happy endings that we... Yeah. You know, so for us that was the main focus, and then everything that's happened after that and the response to it has just been really lovely, you know. It's been really surprising. Nice.
Mm. And so as you mentioned, you played at South by Southwest in Austin, and Netflix kind of came into the conversation after that, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, our producer, Kathy O'Neill, was there with us, and he was having all those meetings while we were... What were we doing? Watching movies or at the pub, really, weren't we?
We were just
doing karaoke. We
swanning around, feeling quite proud of ourselves, puffing out our chests, giving each other pats on the back, saying, yeah, well done, look at that, America's
well
got
done,
it.
Mate.
America's got our funny little stupid movie.
Don't say stupid. Endearing, beautiful.
Stupid in a cool way.
Relevant, like, you know, like relatable movie.
Bad.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I see. Oh, it's street talk.
Yeah, street talk.
Stupid in a smart way.
So I think that's right. Kathy was having those meetings during that festival, and I think the deal was done pretty quickly after that festival, which was very exciting for us. We were very, very happy.
I mean, I'm a huge. I'm not just saying this because Netflix are right over there, but I'm a huge Netflix.
Sarah from Netflix is sitting just behind.
Right there.
She's giving you a look. Get this part on message.
Like, we did an interview today, and it was like they were talking about The Bachelor, and they're like, everyone's obsessed with The Bachelor around here. I'm like, I actually don't watch network television. Like, I don't really watch network television, which is probably terrible. But, you know, Netflix is kind of like the go-to. So it's really exciting to feel like we're going to be part of that. And, you know it's good when your, like, family is impressed by it. What's happening in the film? Oh, we're going to be on Netflix. People are like, you've made it. You've hit the big time. You must be really rich. Have you got a house now? Yeah, a couple of houses. Like, yeah, people are pretty impressed.
When are we getting paid, Sarah? Are we getting paid?
No, we did a really good deal where they get the film and we don't get paid.
Oh, we just get to come to New York.
Yeah, we got this.
That's fun.
This is the payment
this
right
is
here,
fun.
This
we don't
interview.
Have to pay for this water.
I should have had that piece of bread. Netflix has been very good to us. Very good.
And
that's
it's
very
exciting to think that we could, this film, like the number of people that this film could possibly get to. Because it's really hard to get people to go to the movies, to go to the cinema now, unless you're like a big, you know, blockbuster or your 3D. You know, like it was hilarious when we put the film out in New Zealand. We'd be at a cinema multiplex and there'd be like Thor, the Avengers, you know, and they'd all have like three or four cinemas each, and then there'd be
Deadpool.
Like Breaker Upper is in the corner. All these huge, and that were literally every other film at the multiplex in New Zealand was a big like blockbuster superhero film. So that's what you're up against.
But
you know?
We still hang, and just to celebrate this fact, though, I'm really into celebrating while I'm in America. But we were the best of the biggest New Zealand film last year.
Yeah, we were.
Did you know that? Yeah. We were the only New Zealand film last year.
I mean,
but,
you could also.
But we were also. No, we weren't the only.
It's like
another
a point
one.
Of difference as well. Because, like, you know, people are. Maybe the market's oversaturated with superhero films. I don't know. I'm a little bit sick of superhero films.
Are you? Ooh, contentious. You know, I actually saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. A few weeks ago, and I loved it.
Yeah, but there's still some sort
one.
Of like revolutionary storytelling.
That was amazing.
And
I was like, these guys are clever. We met those guys.
I'm into
actually.
It like with something like Thor, when it's like a breath of fresh air.
Yeah,
or like,
something
or
different.
Like
you need something different now. Yeah. But can I just go back to some stats?
Didn't like Doctor, what's his
Doctor Who?
Doctor Strange? No.
Oh,
Strange.
Yeah, let's talk more about superhero films.
Can I get back
to the statistics? Can I just say what is mind blowing for us? And I'm not just talking about Netflix because Sarah's in the room. But you know, we opened in New Zealand and it went really well in New Zealand, our film. But we've got to remember there's only 4 million people in our entire country. Only a few of those people go to the cinema. I mean, to be on Netflix is like, it's quite mind blowing coming from the bottom of the world where there's only 4 million people in our country. It's like suddenly, holy heck.
Yeah.
I'm not going to finish that sentence, but.
Yeah.
It's pretty.
It's just, and the access is just.
That's amazing. Pretty buzzy. Is that a street word? Buzzy?
Buzzy is a street word, yes.
It's pretty buzzy, you know?
I don't know if they say that here in America. I don't know if buzzy's a street word in America. I think it's probably a street word in Auckland, New Zealand.
Oh, okay. It's pretty exciting anyway.
Yeah, it's real exciting.
You're both busy actresses, but it sounds like you are also thinking about your next film together.
We are thinking about it, aren't we, Madeline?
Yeah, we've got a couple of ideas a little bouncing around. Yeah. We also have a few opportunities to direct some things together as well, which will be fun. Just putting the one hat on and just doing the
directing. Just
directing,
you know, yeah. Cutting out that 7 years of writing. We're quite keen on that. So we've been pitching to co-direct scripts that are already written, which I think is a genius plan.
Yeah, and bring our sort of our flavour and our sense of humour to new projects, American projects.
And some of our street lingo, maybe.
Some of our buzzy street language.
Yeah. So you're looking at projects as a director, as directors, potentially nothing definite to talk about yet?
Nothing confirmed. What I'm going to say is, and this is a technical term, nothing confirmed. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Is it a technical term?
What is now?
we're in negotiations.
Yeah. Which is exciting, but and we're also doing some independent stuff. But I'm looking forward to getting back on screen with Madeline and doing some more improv. That was my favourite part of the break group, was just saying stupid stuff to each other.
My favourite part of the break group was falling asleep in the edit after flying back from LA.
You were often asleep in the edit.
Yeah.
Madeline did very little of that.
Ah, it's bullshit. I did heaps.
You did. Yeah,
sorry. No, we swear a lot in New Zealand. I'm sorry if I said
that's
bullshit.
That's allowed. Yeah, absolutely.
Cussing.
Our producer told us not to swear as much in America.
Yeah, he was really.
I think people like that, though. That's what they want.
Do they?
It feels real.
Fuck yeah.
You know
it
feels what? Street.
Street. I want to be myself in America. I don't want to be someone I'm not, you know?
Oh, right. I just want to be, like, fucking buzzy, you know? This is coming out of a 42-year-old white woman's mouth. I mean, it's terrible. It's very embarrassing.
Buzzy. Oh, no.
It's terrible. It's a joke.
I'll explain it to you later what buzzy is.
Have a dinner with Sarah.
Before I let you go, are there any final thoughts or things that you want people to know, the Netflix audience to know about The Breaker Operas?
It's fun. It's colourful. It's not too long. It's just the right length.
It's a really good length to watch. Movie.
I reckon it's a really great movie to watch, like the most amazing movie to watch, like on a chair or on a couch or even lying down on a sheepskin with your legs up in the air, like any kind of position. I think
it's also a really good movie to watch with your friends.
Oh yeah,
like
that's more serious.
Like,
yeah, that's good.
A lot of the first like people out of South by Southwest were like, you know, they'd come up to us and be like, and I was there with my friend, and we were both like looking at each other like, oh, you do that, or you do that, or we were singing the songs together and stuff. So I think it's a really good one to watch with your
good mates.
Yeah. Make a night of it, man, you know? Get some popcorn, some Cheetos.
Tell them what to eat.
Some beer.
Like grab a chair or a couch or, you know, or a sheepie, a little sheepskin. And then you grab the Cheetos. And then I think you've got everything you need. You've got to find the remote. Get the remote.
Find the remote.
Well, sometimes there's an on-off button. I don't know if people, on off, if you don't have the remote.
Yeah, it's
an on-off
button at the back. You're all logged in.
Just log.
That can be a hassle. Put it on your favourites.
Your
favourite it.
Yeah, it's nice.
Put it on your list.
And on that note, you should all go watch The Breaker Upperers. I watched it and I loved it. My one regret is I didn't watch it with any friends, and I have to rectify that soon. But Jackie and Madeline,
you can watch it again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome back to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And we are now joined by Brian Heater. Welcome back, Brian.
Hello, friends.
We're going to talk some more about Russian Doll, which John Schieber and I did sort of like a very kind of cursory, just
initial impressions last week, but now we're really going to get in it. We're going to start again by, I think, talking about initial impressions. So if you haven't seen the show yet, you're safe for now. But I think at a certain point, we're going to want to get into spoilers.
Speaking of people who haven't seen the show, Jordan, you want to kick us off?
I have seen the show. Okay. I watched like 2.5 episodes or whatever. And, so I think I bring a different perspective to it because I'm not saturated in the story the same way that you guys are.
I see you're not jaded.
But, yeah. The way we are. I guess. Maybe. Or like maybe I haven't drunk the Kool-Aid yet. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
That's fair.
But so here's the thing. Like it hasn't hooked me. I'm interested for sure, but it hasn't hooked me. And I think part of the issue is that the way that it was described to me, and this isn't a spoiler to anyone, it's in the Netflix description, I believe, but you know, the way that it was described to me by multiple people was just that this girl dies over and over again at a party, or like dies and shows up at a party, dies and shows up at a party. To me, that is like so just, I don't know how to picture that or frame that or like categorize that kind of description. Is it funny? Like, is it like The Good Place? Or is it like sci-fi and like thrillery? Like, I just didn't understand how to categorize it. And so coming into it, like, I don't think it knows what it is either. And so it just like, it confused me. And yeah, I think there are a lot of things that are really good about it. It's like really funny. And I am interested in the mystery, but I feel like that's moving really slowly. Like, what the hell is actually happening with her? Feels like a plot line that is like completely left behind in a lot of instances.
What's funny about that is the synopsis that you gave perfectly describes the up to where you've seen in the series.
Oh, so I just missed like the last hump, essentially. I was just getting over the hump.
First two episodes are really, there is kind of a struggle for her to get beyond the confines of the party, but it very much does get, I mean, that was something that concerned me going into it too. Obviously the Groundhog Day parallels are there almost immediately, and it seemed like it would probably be the most frustrating 7 episodes of anything if she never left the confines of the little yeshiva party that she's at. But it gets much broader, I think, probably right around the 3rd episode or so.
Yeah, so like in the 3rd episode, I got like maybe part of the way through the 3rd episode, and she was still falling down the fucking stairs. And by then I was like, okay, well.
And you're a Natasha Lyonne fan, or at least, I mean, you like her in Orange is the New Black, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And I like want to, you know, I want to support. And she is fantastic in this. She's so funny. And there are a bunch of people who are really funny. Her friend who keeps offering her the joint is really funny. Yeah, and but there are also things that are just so weird about, like, aren't you guys like a little weirded out by the door? Like, does the door have anything to do with it? Like, I don't know, just there are certain there are certain things that were just kind of weird and off, and it was like substituting weird and off things for like figuring out what the hell's going on frustrated me. I just wanted to get there a little faster.
Okay, let me ask you a question that's going to half double as a spoiler, so look out.
I'm prepared. Are our readers, I mean our listeners,
wait, is this a real spoiler or is this
it's
sort
a
like
semi-spoiler spoiler. It's a kind of a spoiler. Should I hold it off? Because
let's hold off. Okay, let's hold off.
I just want to see exactly how far she's gotten into it, because there's a thing that happens that I think opens it up in a really nice way. And
right, so I think basically at the end of the 3rd episode, that's kind of like where I think the show kind of, as a in terms of the plot, gets really interesting. Right? Would you agree with that?
I mean, okay, let me contextualize it for you. So this is my suggestion to do this episode, not knowing that you guys had discussed a couple of these, because last week I was very sick. I did not leave my apartment for about 7 days. And toward the end of it, somebody recommended the show that I hadn't heard of. So I basically watched this in one sitting in one like crazy sweaty fever dream. So okay. this is where I'm having a little bit of trouble kind of drilling down the specifics of where all of these events happen. But
well, it's also a hard episode to keep track of what's happening when, I feel like. I mean, I'm not very far, but like, because the timeline starts over, eventually, right. I like, you know, you start losing track a little bit of what's happening in front of you.
I would, for the genre question, I would qualify this as a dark comedy
sci-fi
with
I
would say dark comedy with fantastical elements.
I would say, I mean, so the thing that people compare it to a lot is Groundhog Day. I mean, for, you know, obvious sort of conceptual reasons. Do you guys think that, like, tonally, it's kind of in the same space as well?
I think it shares things in common, but the difference between the two is the series starts off darker, whereas, like, there are some very dark elements in Groundhog Day, which is a 25-year-old film that I feel okay spoiling. There's that suicide montage.
Right.
Where it's just like him killing himself like after another. So there are moments where it does get dark. I think that this is, it starts off a little bit more serious and bleaker. And I do think it takes a little bit for some of the comedic elements to start to show themselves.
In this show?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I thought it was pretty funny right off the bat. But then it like twists and turns really dark like every once in a while. And it's just, I don't know. I do like it though. And I think it's, it reminds me a little bit of the genre around, well, it reminds me of The Good Place, honestly, just because of the fantastical elements you're speaking of, Brian. Do you guys watch The Good Place?
I've seen some of it, but I haven't really like done a deep dive.
What?
I know the twist at the end of the first season, but like that's about as far as I've gotten.
You're so weird.
He's watched,
what you do and don't know.
He's watched the first and last episodes of the first season.
Yes, but also the second episode.
Did you skip to the end?
The first episode I watched was the first season finale. Sorry. Anyway, continue.
Wow. What a lame way to watch that show.
It's, I think we can all agree that you're a weirdo, Anthony. I think that
the shows that you choose to do it with are the worst possible ones. That's the thing. Like, they're the worst ones that you could choose to do that with.
I was still very surprised when we got to the twist.
Yeah, of course you were surprised at the twist. You didn't have any context for it.
Anyway, Brian, you were saying that you were in like a fever dream when were watching this. And I think that, see, I was like tired and just, you know, trying to watch something before bed, kind of chill. And like, this is kind of a fever dream show. Like, there were certain scenes where she's like getting so high. It just like gave me anxiety just to like think about it. I don't know. It was just like so intense. And it wasn't the right like before bed show, I feel like. But maybe it is the right like fever dream show.
Oh, no, it's very much, you know? It's not a chill out show. For sure.
No, but it didn't make me feel chill.
But I would definitely suggest you continue, because I think you're the first person I've spoken to who didn't enjoy it or didn't watch it through to the end. Everyone else I've spoken to pretty much at this point has been very much into it.
But I do think that some people I've talked to, they'll sort of be like, yeah, the first couple episodes were fine, but then as they get further in, they kind of get sucked in. It's not a show that like you necessarily watch one episode and you're like, yeah, like I'm 100% on board. At least that's been what I've been hearing from people. I enjoyed the first couple episodes, but I think that the plot stuff that we were kind of talking about doesn't really kick in until further down the road. I do think there's also this challenge of, if you think about the kind of like Groundhog Day repeating format, is that there's always going to be this part at the beginning, also Happy Death Day, which is a very good movie, highly recommend, there's like this always the beginning part where the person is figuring out that they're repeating the day, and it's a little bit tough because as an audience you already know what the concept is, and so you have to, you know, they have to have that, because it's not believable if the person just immediately understands what's going on. But it can also be frustrating if you spend too much time with it. I think Russian Doll did a pretty good job of making it funny, of like that she becomes obsessed with the drugs and then she becomes obsessed with the building. And even though I think you kind of know that that's probably not what the explanation is, if only because we're only two episodes into an 8-episode series, I think it was like fine that we kind of go down a lot of these weird dead ends.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was... I almost got the feeling it was like purposefully designed to be frustrating, which is a strange thing to say about a TV series. So maybe in a strange way, this is kind of a product of the sort of original content binging era, right? In that this is very much something that was meant to be watched, I think, in a couple of sittings. It's not something that's really designed to hook you right away in the way that it would be if they had a more traditional television debut or pilot.
Yeah, it like they can afford a little bit more, you know, build up and kind of like anticipation built in there. Because I am the kind of person who really will latch on to a mystery, and I will suffer through a lot for it once I care about it. But it was like, if you don't give me enough, and I feel like you said, Anthony, there's so many dead ends. And the dead ends were like, in the right mindset, could have been really entertaining for me, but they were really, really just frustrating and annoying for me in the mood that I was in last night. So maybe that's like a me thing more than it's the show thing. But I do think that like, had I sat down feeling like a little bit more ready for something like that, I would, that frustration would have turned into like just more watching and more investment, you know?
I would say if the one thing that's really compelling you to do it is what the mystery is. I don't know if that's a good enough reason in and of itself, because I don't think that is at all the best part of the series. I do think the journey to get there is very interesting. And I think the relationships between all of these characters, I think as a New Yorker, it's kind of a wonderful show because it does sort of touch on some of those aspects that we don't see in kind of like more traditional television series. But the without any spoiler, I do think that the reason why all of this has been set in motion is perhaps a bit of a disappointment.
Yeah, I think it's a little anticlimactic. I don't know if you become too fixated on the mystery side of it and figuring out why there's kind of a fun explanation, but it's not, if your satisfaction of the show hangs on that, I don't know that you're going to be too satisfied by the end.
I would say hang in there for the fact that it's like one of the best soundtracks I've heard in television show in a very long time. And at least, this isn't a spoiler, at least get as far as seeing Chloe Sevigny's performance in it, because she's awesome and it adds a lot to the series.
Okay, I can do those
things. All right, should we just get into spoilers? Is this the time?
Yeah.
Why not? Yeah.
Right, so we are going to spoil it. So if you have not watched the show, which Jordan has not finished, so you know she's going to about to get spoiled. You can listen, but you know,
if you want to hear Jordan get spoiled, then
she's about to get spoiled. That wording. Thank you.
We're just going to send her a lot of flowers and candies.
Jesus. Okay. I'm ready.
All right.
What happens?
Okay.
What's the fucking mystery?
No, not the mystery. Like I said, it's more about the journey than the destination very much in this series. But the thing that hooks you and that brought me in, because I agree with you, and this happens to me a lot with these kinds of like limited series. I start watching the first episode and I get frustrated because I can't figure out how the hell they're going to drag this over the course of eight episodes. And like, it kills me. And the idea, as fun as those characters were, the idea of them going like just constantly in and out of the party was super frustrating to me. But right around the time you dropped off, they introduce a new character who is experiencing the same thing that she is going through.
Yeah, that is exactly what I was thinking of too, is that when you realize there's a second person who's going through the sort of the same
time
loop.
Yeah, that was exactly the moment that I left off on.
Oh, you did? Okay, so you finished the third episode. Yeah.
And I was like, damn. But then by then I was like, I had already kind of dozed halfway through that episode. So I was like, I don't want to keep watching it because I literally couldn't keep my eyes open. I think I'm catching a cold, but
yeah, I think this is more a problem with your sleep schedule, Jordan.
No, it wasn't a sleep schedule thing. It was like 11:15 or whatever. But I just needed to get to sleep. But anyways, that's not the point. The point is that now that you remind me of that I saw that at the end, that was a big motivator. Last night I do remember thinking, well, I'm gonna have to finish that. But then I forgot about it by the time that I was up again this morning.
He's a really good character. I wasn't actually familiar with the actor at all. I've been a fan of her since the Songs of Beverly Hills Days. I think she's great, and everyone was really good in it. I hadn't heard of this guy. His introduction, I mean, they're okay, so there's the moment in the final episode where they're both in the elevator, which is a great moment. It's a little slow build, I think, up to him, but he's ends up being a really good and interesting character, and I think a very good counterpoint to Natasha Lyonne's character.
Well, it's also that it's really satisfying because you realize that there's been this one character, this guy in the background who, when she would go in these loops, that he would not fit back into place, like that she would go to the store and one night somebody would be like knocking stuff over and the next night he wouldn't be there. And you realize that's him, that he's also running around as this the one other unpredictable element. And so realizing the way they've been setting that up for the three episodes before, I think also just felt very, very satisfying. But I also agree that like the actor's name is Charlie Barnett. I haven't heard of him before. He like plays this kind of in a lot of ways, like they bounce off each other really well because he's this very buttoned down, like, you know, like kind of very like stiff and like really fixated on routine.
Every single morning they establish his character every single morning. He feeds his beta fish one piece of fish food.
And then he's also, I like the other thing I like about him is the first time you see him, he said like, or rather after the point where you left off, Jordan, then you actually see some of the story from his perspective. And the first time you see him, he's starting one of these cycles and he just says 10. And then at a certain point you realize he's just counting every time he dies. And there's just like a lot of little stuff like that where, again, I don't think it like makes sense in the kind of broader, you know, it still is like this kind of loopy fantasy world, but that you feel like they're kind of putting in all these details that pay off, I think is really satisfying.
Sure. And another spoiler, they always die for different reasons at the exact same time.
Really?
Yeah. It becomes a really satisfying show because you realize that it's not something where they're trying to figure out how they can possibly get this to go over the course of like 7 or 8 episodes. It's actually really intricately and I think pretty complexly woven in a way that is incredibly satisfying. And it goes just down to all of those things that she sees the first time they pretty much like everything that you see from the, you know, the homeless guy to the guy in the bodega to the I think she sleeps with the shitty guy right away. Like he becomes a professor. A horrible but super interesting character. Turns out a lot of their fates are sort of like interwoven into one another. There's some really cool flashbacks. That's where you get Chloe Sevigny's character as her I don't know if they ever say what her deal is, but you know, perhaps like schizophrenic or bipolar disorder mother, and how all these things sort of fell into place to lead her to where she is in her life now.
Interesting.
Jordan, you were talking about the door at the beginning. There's not like an explanation, but like that, like I think that's a very intentional effect to have this kind of weird trippy thing on the door, and that at some point they do sort of talk about it. And then even further down the road, there's this. So my favorite episode is the second to last episode, the 7th episode, which is where basically everything starts. Like there are little hints that there's still this kind of either time passing or things are sort of decaying. Like as the show goes on, like you see more and more food that's starting to rot, plants are dying, and then eventually people start disappearing. And so in the 7th episode, it gets really intense where there's like a lot of cycles and each one, like more stuff disappears and the world becomes more and more empty. And it is very, very well done and very, very creepy. And that's also where they get into some of the emotional stuff with her mother. So for me, that was definitely kind of like the peak of the series.
Yeah, I think probably it's again, very effective for New York people too. It paints life in the city very, very well. But just sort of a lot of the isolation that they deal with, a lot of the things that she engages with. I mean, you know, the drugs do come back. I mean, I wouldn't say it's so much of a cautionary tale, but the way they do sort of circle back into her life as she's sort of been using them as dependents and to deal with a lot of these issues she's been dealing with. I think he's a really good, he almost reminded me, I've read a lot of this probably won't surprise you, Anthony, but I've read a lot of Japanese fiction over the years, and there's a lot of really great stories. I think the Japanese do it better than anyone else, except maybe like the existentialists, but of just isolated lives inside of the city, you know, in sort mm-hmm. of a, like a very population dense place. And I think his character is such a great version of that. Somebody who just sort of like mostly goes through his life, kind of keeps to himself. And they're both very clearly at a, you know, it's, I think it's both of their 36 birthdays, and they're both very clearly at this breaking point when this weird thing just kind of happens to the fabric of the universe.
Right. Well, and that even though she has friends and has this giant party, that it's a different kind of isolation, that you kind of, it still feels like she doesn't have a lot of close relationships, and that, you know, I mean, I'm not 100% sure how much of this was intentional, because I think at some point we were like watching the party scene over and over, and my roommate who was watching it with me was like, do these people actually know her? Because it kind of feels like most of the people at the party aren't really her friends and seem kind of confused by her. But like that there is, I think at least to some level, an intentional feeling also of isolation of her character, even if she, you know, that she can be surrounded, which is the other kind of city thing of that you can be surrounded by all these people, but not necessarily feel a connection.
Sure. I mean, one of the things we see, you know, you're talking about the kind of the breakdown of the plants, and things start disappearing from the walls, and people also start, that's where it really kind of kicks in for her, is when people start disappearing from the party. And by the end, it's just her one good friend.
Right. Yeah. And that feels, yeah, like it speaks to something in her emotional state already.
So I was reading somewhere, they described it as the first season of the show, which that can't be right. It's that just gotta insane. Be the self-contained miniseries. I mean, it seems to be much more successful than, and it's been a better response than anyone was expecting. But I do care enough about these characters to want to watch them outside of the context of this time loop.
Wait, so do they have a sense of, is it definitely following these characters, or is it potentially different characters?
There's no. I've not heard mention of being renewed for the second season beyond the notion that this was a first season rather than a self-contained miniseries.
So is there room for that?
Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point. I think you gotta go one of two ways. You can either front the characters again. I don't, you know, you can't really, I don't think you can just keep doing time loops with people. You've either got to do that or just one other kind of weird, you know, fantasy element.
I guess I feel like I like the, I do like the characters, but the story feels totally complete by the end of it. And you know, that it ends on exactly the right moment. So I'm, you know, I guess I think the creative team has done so well with this that I guess I have a degree of faith that they wouldn't do it unless a second season, unless they had something interesting to do with it. But in terms of just looking at the situation at the end of the season, it seems totally done, and that like any other season would be completely redundant.
Yeah, which is fine. Again, I think like I was saying before, as far as pacing, that's something that places like Netflix and Hulu have afforded, the fact to not have an instantaneous payoff. And I think in the same way, it's made it a lot possible to have these limited miniseries. Like, I don't think they're under kind of the same kind of constraints. You know, this is something that people talk about a lot, like the difference between American sitcoms and British sitcoms is those tend to run, you know, 2-3 series, and they're like 6 or 7 episodes each, versus American ones, which are, you know, go like 10 years and end up being 26 episodes a season. And that really kills it. And I think this is at a very nice place where, you know, I don't think you particularly want more. It ties it up. It's maybe not the most satisfying ending in the world, but it's a very good self-contained thing.
I agree with that. Jordan, do you want us to explain sort of what the explanation is, or do you want to, should we let you discover that on your own?
It's not going to bother me if you explain it. It might help me watch it. So go for it.
Sure. So, In a way that on a very basic level, it's Groundhog Day. It actually, I guess, it's also kind of Groundhog Day in this respect too, and it fits in with a lot of other series and movies over the years. In that, they basically both died leaving something unfulfilled, They spend several episodes toward the end. I think when you're about three quarters of the way through the series, she's a computer programmer. So she has the idea that, they're in basically some kind of bug loop and they need to figure out how to debug it. And, he takes sort of the more traditional movie approach to it, which is that, something happened. They died maybe a little bit ahead of their time. And in order to get things back to normal, they have to address those issues.
Right. They have to go fulfill whatever they left unfulfilled.
Yeah. There's sort of two things they kind of talk about at the same time. One is that they had this encounter on the first night, which is where they both could have saved each other's lives and didn't because they were kind of too caught up in their own shit. And so part of it is they have to just go back and
the guy that you see having a really bad night inside of the bodega is him.
Yeah, I knew that.
And then later it turns out that basically after that encounter in the bodega, he goes home and kills himself. And so that they have to kind of go back and replay that encounter in the bodega in a different way. But then also, at the same time, both of them have, like, I think a lot of other baggage that they kind of end up dealing with. And it's not 100% clear how important that is for fixing, getting out of the loop. But I think it seems like you're sort of implied that they have to do that too. And there's not, it's not really clear how all of that fits together in sort of a logical way, but emotionally it's
yeah, there's satisfying. Kind of a great moment where they figure out that first part about their debts and they're kind of just standing in the bodega and like nothing is happening, cause they're both going through it together. So she's not like, doesn't make sense that she would save him from it. And, something that we both left out of the story is that, she gets little glitches in the matrix and she keeps seeing herself younger as a child.
Oh,
and she dies every time she does.
That leads to a little bit of a flashback and that kind of opens things up a little bit deeper. You sound thrilled by the synopsis, Jordan.
I mean,
it's not like a great explanation. It's more just kind of like it all comes together emotionally, I would say.
I do think that is just like the main thing with Russian Doll that I think is, and we've struggled with it the whole podcast long. I mean, me too. I haven't seen it all, but even you guys in like trying to talk about it and explain it, you can't really get across what I think is good or special about it. Right? Like it's hard to, I don't know. It's hard to describe. It's very complicated.
Right. If you reduce it to a plot summary,
yeah,
then a lot of times you're like, well, no, but it sounds like it's one thing, but actually the feeling of it is this other thing that's kind of hard to put into words.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. I mean, it does, again, it is a reason why people keep comparing it to Groundhog Day. I mean, it's very much that plot. And again, this idea of kind of being like unfulfilled is, none of those are particularly exciting ideas at this point, and we've both seen them rehashed 100 times. I would say it's a combination of the writing, the performances, the interactions between the characters. And again, I really love the soundtrack. I think the soundtrack, it's a fantastic collection of songs, and it does so much to add to the movie. Just that like Harry Nilsson song that they keep playing over and over again. It really heightens the emotion, and I do think it's the
one that she hears every time
the one that plays right at the beginning of the series. And there's just all of these really kind of wonderful elements that mingle together in a really nice way, and it's very enjoyable and fulfilling.
I agree. Is there anything else that we want to talk about related to Russian Doll?
It's very good.
Not for me.
Jordan should watch more of it.
I will watch more. I'll like just chime in, on the next podcast with.
You can get John Schieber back on.
Completed thoughts.
It'll be like when you would just, we would do like little mini Star, like where are you in your Star Wars, like watch for the first time kind of recaps at the beginning. This will just be like Jordan catching up on Russian Doll.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, you guys have been doing the show for a while now, Anthony especially.
Uh-huh.
And every single week you're out of a sense of obligation required to either watch a movie or in some cases like a mini series or an entire season of something. And I'm wondering, like, how much that has impacted both your viewing habits and your enjoyment of these things. Because some, like, I'm assuming that in a lot of cases, this is probably not one of them, but in a lot of these cases, it's something that you, like, likely just wouldn't watch of your own volition.
I think it depends on, well, like, Anthony and I are pretty good about taking turns choosing things, so... Obviously, I'm choosing things that organically I want to watch anyway, and I'm a pretty voracious consumer of content in general. So, like new stuff that would come out on Netflix or Hulu or whatever is probably something I would give a chance to a lot of the time. So when it's my choice, it's nice. And I would say my habits in that, I mean, yeah, sometimes it blows, like if, for example, like I really ended up enjoying this, but like I definitely wasn't in the zone to watch the what's the Netflix Oscar movie? Why can't I think of the
Roma.
Name of it? Roma, right. Like I wasn't really like in the zone for Roma, and it really did capture my heart in a lot of ways. So bravo to that. But like sometimes it blows to sit down and be like, okay, well, we have to podcast tomorrow. And even though this isn't what I would choose to watch tonight, like tonight's the night I have to watch it. So that kind of blows sometimes, but I think it's opened my mind to trying more stuff, especially original content. Like, I think there are some gems in there. There is a lot of just shit that's being thrown against the wall, but there's some gems in there too that are kind of lurking as
but,
well.
But this is something you think that you would have at least given the initial chance to either way.
Yeah. Yeah. People had been recommending it and stuff to me. Like sometimes these shows come out and like, I very much like trend in a certain direction. I'll watch like 20 crime documentaries at once. And then I'll watch like 20, you know, high school teeny bopper, like, you know, dramas. And then, you know, I go in like phases. So if I try to throw something in, I tend to not enjoy it as much because I'm like really in a certain mood, you know?
Yeah. I'm glad that somebody recommends me because I was in a dark place with my... with my movie
with
watching.
Your illness.
Well, no, with just like what, like the stuff that I've been watching. So like, obviously we watched both Firefester documentaries. I watched the Ted Bundy series. I watched the entirety of the, it's all 7 or 8 episodes of that R. Kelly series. I was just like,
here's the thing, Brian, yeah. I did the exact same schedule as you, just everything you just described. But then to pull out of that, I went to New Girl.
Mm.
So then to jump back into Russian Doll from New Girl and The Bachelor, I've been doing New Girl and The Bachelor and like This Is Us and like real kind of feel good, soft stuff. And to jump into Russian Doll was like a jump back down. And you know what I mean? Jump back down the into darkness.
See, for me, it was sort of like, you know, like easing into the bath, you know, like,
yeah, no, it was a level up for you, yeah, but it was like for me.
It wasn't quite like trash TV, but it was a nice easy transition away from Ted Bundy.
The ultimate compliment.
Yeah. To answer your question, Brian, for me, I think like it's definitely like, I've watched stuff that I probably wouldn't watch on my own, like especially documentaries and true crime, which Jordan is a lot more interested in than I am. But I'm like glad that I get to check that stuff out. I think what has changed for me is firstly, like stuff that kind of falls in the middle where I'm like, oh, this is cool. I've watched the first couple episodes and we've talked about it. I'd like to keep going. I think like realistically with sort of how much stuff comes out, how much stuff we have to watch for the podcast, a lot of the times like, yeah, I'm probably never going to finish this just cause, or at least, you know, for a while, because like there's some new thing we've got to watch the next week. So that's been a little bit tough. And then I think the other thing that's changed is how much I value short things and how much like, if I'm like trying to get through like a certain number of episodes in a given night before we podcast. And I think people who've listened to a lot of the episodes will notice this too, is like, I'll praise stuff when it feels very tight and like gets through a lot of story in a relatively few episodes. And Russian Doll is an interesting example of that, because in some ways it definitely like is not plot driven, is not like that it sort of goes down these dead ends like we've been talking about. But at the same time, it's a short show, you know, only 8 episodes of half an hour or less. And so you could watch the entire series in one night, conceivably. And so in that sense, I think that probably increased my appreciation for it, that just the idea of binging it seems so manageable.
Yeah, I think there's so many reasons why it was a show that like just wouldn't have existed in another era. And like not the least of which is, you know, Natasha Lyonne is someone who's been acting professionally for a really long time. She's somebody who like, who people who follow movies and TV shows know, but I don't, for all of her, you know, charms and talents, and there are many, I don't know that she's necessarily somebody who, in a more sort of traditional media TV atmosphere, whether she would have been given like a starring series. So like that's definitely a marked benefit for this. I mean, it's been getting a lot of buzz, so maybe this means that she's getting some more starring roles going forward. Not that she's not a good supporting and character actress, but like she definitely proved that she could carry this.
I completely agree.
Yeah, and we should also say that not only is she the star, but she's also co-creator, co-wrote a number of the episodes, and directed the final episode. So, I mean, there's also Leslie Headland, I think, who's a filmmaker I really like. She made Bachelorette and Sleeping with Other People, was the kind of the other major creative force. And
there's
other
Poehler
writers and other directors,
somehow?
But Natasha Leo. Yeah, Amy Poehler is also a co-creator. She, I think, has fewer credits on the different episodes. So probably was maybe a little bit more hands-off, but that like, clearly, like Natasha Lyonne was like super involved behind the scenes too. It wasn't just that she's the star. So why don't we wrap things up? Just as a reminder to all of our listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe on Pocket Casts or any other podcast app that you enjoy. You can also leave us a review in Apple Podcasts or other apps. We'd appreciate all of that. Brian also has a podcast of his own, RIYL Cast. Who have you had on recently, Brian?
We just had Michael Franti, the famous musician Michael Franti of Spearhead, was just on. Lou Olakowski, she's a NPR host. Douglas Rushkoff was just on. We put out an episode a week. Got a lot of good ones coming up. We're on all those servers, and also Spotify, which now has podcasts.
That's right. Cool. Yeah. So everyone go check out RIYL. I hope you have already, but if you haven't, go do it now. And Jordan and Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.